So tonight's Dhamma talk is based on a sutta called the Ten Noble Abodes. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya, which Anguttara basically means numerical. So this is a yet another collection of the Buddha's discourses, but they're sorted by the number of things that are mentioned. Like there's a selection on the ones, a selection on the twos, a selection on the threes. This is from the selections of things on the tens. And it isn't exhaustive. It doesn't have every sutta he ever said, but it has all the sort of the interesting ones are the ones that are considered essential that aren't in one of the other two main things, you know, they're not in the Majjhima Nikaya or the Samyutta Nikaya. And when I first started studying this, I thought, I was looking at this and sort of studying the whole book at one point. And I kept coming across like, oh, isn't that interesting? It's like things are said in a different way, or they're expressed in a different way. It's just the language is different sometimes. And then you see that eventually it's the Buddhist teachings, but just put in different sort of form. So this is how this begins. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Kurus, where there's a town of the Kurus. There the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "There are, O monk, these ten noble abodes, where the noble ones have abided in the past, where they abide at present, and where they will abide in the future." So notice he's saying this is something that, these are things that endure. They're not like just the local latest fad. What ten? Here, monks. A monk has abandoned five factors, possesses six factors, has a single guard, has a fourfold support, has driven away the many separate truths, has given up seeking, has clarified his thoughts, has calmed down his bodily formation, and has become well liberated in mind and well liberated by wisdom. So you hear this and it's like, it's pretty cryptic, right? It's like, this is like a list, and it's like, you know, the in crowd would know immediately what he's talking about. But what he then does is he then goes through and explains each of these. And so that's what I want to do in this talk, is go through this list. But before I do that, I want to remind you about the word abode. An abode is where we live, right? And so he's not talking about a physical building. He's talking about where we live here at the heart. Where do we live in our heart mind? Where do we aspire? That's the word I was looking for. Where do we aspire to always function from this place? Always be. And also, an abode is a place where we're protected, where we feel safe, like we're in our own house, right? So it's has this dual meaning in a sense. So let's just sort of go through this list, and I have some other commentaries I want to read on some of this. So this is the first one. And how has a monk abandoned five factors? Here, monk has abandoned sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. Thus he has abandoned five factors. So this list, here we are, this is the list inside the list, right? There's several of them. This list is like the five, what are called the five kilesas. You know, the five obstructions to practice. The five things that when we don't see them clearly, they arise in the mind and we don't see them clearly, they just befuddle us, and we can't see clearly. And the key thing here is he says that thus he has abandoned. And once again, this is another key word that you see a lot in the sutta. Abandoned here means, if you look up abandoned in the dictionary, it says then you never go back to something. You abandon something, it means I'm never going to experience any of these five again. I'm not going to let these arise anymore. They're finished. I'm finished with these ones. I'm not going to get caught by the essential desire and doubt and all the other, this list of the famous list of the five choices. So he's basically no longer affected by them. This is an interesting, I want to read a little bit from the, this is from the Majjhima-Nikaya on this topic. So what I'm trying to get at is this is, these are common themes the Buddha goes back to in all kinds of different suttas and says them in sometimes put in eight different ways. And here he's talking about how a noble disciple, one who is practicing, lives in the world. And the monk has gone out on his alms round and acted appropriately, received his food for the day, and now he's back. On returning from his alms round, after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, sitting with body erect and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with the mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. So there's another word, purifying. You know, in the Satipatthana Sutta, at the very beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, the introduction essentially, the Buddha says this practice is a practice of purification. And he's not talking about cleaning the body, that's important. He's talking about cleaning your mind. And the kilesas are the things that clutter up the mind, essentially. Right? He goes on, abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with the mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor. Recipient of light, mindful, and fully aware, he purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. So each of these purifications brings up a different characteristic, right? Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with the mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. So, having reached this state of no longer being affected by the five kilesas, your mind is clear and unaffected, and you're calm and still. That's what he's pointing to. And this is, this is the first of this list of 10. This is where things have to begin, In every retreat I've ever been on, at some point, any sort of longer retreat, at some point one of the teachers gives a talk on the five kilesas. Me included, when I teach a long retreat, I always, at some point, have to talk about the five kilesas. Because it's important that people understand that this is, we have to, if we don't get our minds clear, if we don't abandon these things, it's pretty hard to then open to the pure states. But remember, I'm going to say this several times, this is all aspirational. This is the direction we're headed. It's not like, oh my God, I had a covetous thought, what's wrong with me, I'm so bad. It's just like, oh, now you are mindful that you had a covetous thought, and maybe that mindfulness brings calmness to the mind, and you abandon the covetousness, at least at that moment. Okay, so that's the first of the 10. And then he says, and how does a monk possess six factors? Here, monks, having seen a form with the eye, a monk is neither elated nor dejected, but he dwells equanimous, mindful, clearly comprehending. And so too when he hears a sound with the ear, smells an odor with the nose, savors the taste with the tongue, contacts a tactile object with the body, or cognizes a mental object with the mind. In this way, he possesses the six factors. So this is another of the classic teachings, right? This is where the Buddha is basically saying, that everything, if you really look at it, at one level, one point of looking at things, one view you can take is that everything has to be one of these six things. What's arising is based on one of these six forms of conscious sense perception. And the trick is that when things arise at the sense doors, you remain equanimous. You're not reactive. This is a, once again, let's look at a different sutta. This is the Samyutta Nikaya in the book of the six senses. So the Samyutta Nikaya, remember, is the collected discourses. And each section of the Samyutta Nikaya has gathered together a whole collection of suttas on a particular topic. This section is the second biggest section in the entire Samyutta Nikaya. So this idea of working with the six sense doors, so because we can, I mean, this is like mindfulness of body. You know, it's like you can tune into things, and it's easier, in a sense, to work with mindfulness of the body. And then there's the mental formations, which is mindfulness of mind, of course. Anyhow, this is what he has to say, abandonment. Right? Here we are abandoning again. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the Dhamma for abandoning all. Listen, in what bhikkhus is the Dhamma for abandoning all? The eye is to be abandoned. Forms are being to be abandoned. I consciousness is to be abandoned. I contact is to be abandoned. And whatever feeling arises from eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, this too is to be abandoned. So here he's saying, be unaffected by what arises at the level of eye contact. And then he basically works through saying exactly the same thing. The ear is to be abandoned, the mind is to be abandoned, mental phenomena are to be abandoned, mind consciousness is to be abandoned, mind contact is to be abandoned. So he's basically working through this list of the six senses and saying, once again, we have to abandon, what we're abandoning here is our normal reactive patterns. So when things arise at the sense doors, we usually react. Like, oh, I like that, I don't like that. You know, Vedana arises and we go from there, right? And what he's saying is we have to abandon those reactive patterns. So that's number two. Number three, it took me a while to figure this one out. And how does he have a single guard? Here, monks, a monk possesses a mind guarded by mindfulness. In this way, he has a single guard. It's really a simple one. We just want to make sure that our mind is guarded, our heart mind is guarded by mindfulness. Mindfulness isn't just some fun thing to do, but it's what guards us. Because if we're working on abandoning those first two things, mindfulness is what helps us see, oh, there I am being caught again. I haven't quite abandoned it yet. And it takes us to back to paying more attention to that and gradually learning to abandon it. And so, you know, this is where, you know, once again in the Satipatthana Sutta, there's a line that recurs over and over again. It says, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything. Because we're being mindful, we can abide independent. There's that word abide. Here we are abiding in the abodes again. So these are common themes that the Buddha goes through. But notice the sequence. First is the things that get in the way. And then it says, and just all you really need is mindfulness. Just that. Just be mindful. But this is only number three. Right? So then here we go on. And how does a monk have a fourfold support? Here, monks, a monk uses some things after reflection, endures some things after reflection, avoids some things after reflection, and dispelled some things after reflection. In this way, a monk has a fourfold support. So here he's saying, here's skillful practice sometimes means you, one of these four things might have to happen, right? You might, as he says, you know, you might actually use something. Some things are useful. Some things that arise are actually useful. Some things are just not useful, but there's nothing we can do about it. We have to endure them. Some things we actually avoid them. We say, oh, I want to avoid that. Don't want to go there. And some things we haven't avoided, and there they are. Now we have to dispel them. We have to, oh, let's get rid of that. So now he's talking about how we can apply mindfulness as things arise that we see that we're caught up in them. And some of them, it's okay. I mean, it's okay to be caught up in wholesome thoughts, right? You use them, right? But other things we might, that's what I got. I just have to endure it. It's not like, you know, you're telling yourself this story about something and you're ranting away. And as long as you're aware that that's what's going on, as long as you're mindful of the fact that you're ranting to yourself, ranting is like this, then it isn't, it's now we're just basically sitting there and enduring the fact that this is what's arisen right now in my heart mind, is this rant. But if I'm aware that that's what's happening, it isn't a problem anymore. It's only a problem when we get caught up in it and start to leave it and proliferate from it. So sometimes we just have to endure things, right? Some things we have to go, oh, and we see something coming and we go, no, don't want to go there. I can see where that, I know where that goes. I've been down that road a lot. I know exactly where it ends up. So we avoid it. And some things have arisen and we go, oh, there it is again. I'm going to dispel it. I have to get rid of that. So this is, he's talking about right effort here. These are the classic forms of right effort, right? The four forms of right effort. Then he goes on. This is number five. And how has a monk driven away the many separate truths? Here, monks, there are many separate truths held by diverse ascetics and Brahmins, such as the world is eternal, the world is not eternal, the world is finite, the world is infinite, the soul is one thing and the body another, the soul and the body are the same, the Tathagata exists after death, the Tathagata does not exist after death, the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death, or the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. Monk has discarded all of these, driven them away, renounced and rejected them, released and abandoned and relinquished them. So these are all classical philosophical nonsense, to be polite. Things that we get caught trying to figure out, and various teachers will say, this is how it works. And then some other teachers say, no, it's the opposite. Or, and you can see all the, you know, the combinations he's talking about. And the Buddha, you see this in other sutras as well, where the Buddha is pointing to, here's things that are not worth thinking about. Is the world infinite or finite? Who cares? In terms of practice, who cares? Right? But it's like we can get caught up in trying to figure things out. This is where we get caught in the figuring things out stage of practice sometimes, where, you know, different teachings say different things and we're trying to sort of compare and contrast and think about it instead of just being aware of what's arising. And if what's arising is me thinking about, is the world finite or infinite, then you're just thinking about it and you're aware of it and mindful of it, it's not a problem. It's that we get caught in these things and try and figure them out. And he's, once again, we've abandoned these ideas. We've abandoned trying to think about them and figure them out. Ah, there he goes. Number six. And how has a monk given up seeking? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned the search for sensual pleasure and the search for becoming, and has suspended the search for a holy life. That third one's interesting, huh? In this way, a monk has given up seeking. So we haven't just given up looking for ways to satisfy our sense of sensual pleasure. The search for becoming means giving up the idea of a separate self, because we keep creating a sense of a separate self. We keep becoming over and over and over again. You know, I'm this, I'm that, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm like this and they're like that. You know, that mental process of comparing ourselves to something else or to who we were last day, yesterday, or whatever. And that's called becoming, right? And then a search for the holy life. When I first read that, I went, what the heck is he talking about here? And really, giving up views on what the holy life is. Because we come into practice, and then we develop these ideas of, well, this is what should be happening. I read it in the book that at this point when I'm sitting practicing, this should happen. Or, you know, this teacher should be telling me this now, or explaining this now, or whatever. And we have these, and instead of just paying attention to what's actually there, we're always looking for signs that the holy life is actually there, based on our idea of what the holy life is in the first place. Truth is, we haven't got a clue. You know, we have arrows that point in the direction, but we don't actually know what it would mean to be enlightened. We haven't got a clue. We have images, we have stories, but the actual knowledge, if we think we know what it is, now we've just fooled ourselves again. We've given up, abandoned even that idea of knowing what's happening. We're just doing the practice and seeing what happens. So that's number six. Number seven. And how has a monk clarified his thoughts? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will and thoughts of violence. In this way, a monk has clarified his thoughts. In other words, at a certain point, like, we're not acting or speaking from a place of ill will or desire or ill will. But we still have those thoughts. And eventually, what we're working at is not so much not acting and speaking in certain ways, but seeing if, like, eventually we can clarify the mind to the point where those thoughts cease to arise. I can only imagine this. I mean, this is where the aspiration part starts to really become obvious to me. But it's like, what a great aspiration, to never have thoughts of ill will or anger. I mean, that's like a very wholesome aspiration. As long as we understand it's an aspiration and don't beat ourselves up when we're not always like that. Right? And it's undisturbed in his resolves. So these are resolves. This is like something where we take the resolve to no longer have sensual thoughts or thoughts of ill will and thoughts of violence. We take that resolve. It doesn't mean that taking a resolve means we're always going to succeed. Take a resolve, and then mindfulness is what allows you to see, it reminds you, oh, there's that thought pattern again. And I've taken a resolve not to let that arise anymore, and I'm going to just let it go. I'm going to abandon that thought pattern, whatever it is. Number eight. And how has a monk calmed down the bodily formation? Here, monks, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and sadness, a monk enters and dwells into the fourth jhana, which is neither painful more pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This way, a monk has calmed down bodily formation. So now he's talking about what happens as we go deeper into the practice, especially in terms of concentration, we go through these things called the jhanas. These are purified states of concentration that are successive. And the last of these is the fourth jhana, which is what he's talking about here. So this is like pretty deep into the practice, right? And how? And he says, here, without the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and sadness, a monk enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. So now we're so concentrated and so still and so mindful that there's just the mindfulness, the awareness itself. That's all that's left. We're not paying attention to the detail at all anymore. We're not, like, we're not noting, you know, that itch in my nose, because we don't, we're beyond noticing that. In deep in fourth jhana, your sense of having a physical body disappears. Really, you're beyond physical sensation completely. That's, which means it's neither pleasant nor painful. It just isn't there. You know, you go beyond having bodily experience at all. It's pure mental experience, pure heart mind experience, or so they tell me anyway. I've had tiny glimpses of this on long retreats. By tiny, I mean, you know, tiny, tiny. But I can understand, so I have some vague understanding of what this means. Then he goes on. And how is a monk well liberated in mind? Here, monks, a monk's mind is liberated from lust, hatred, and delusion. In this way, a monk is well liberated in mind. In other words, the mind is liberated. It no longer experiences the three poisons. It isn't like we're struggling against them or having to figure out how to get rid of them. Now it's liberated from. It no longer experiences the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. It would be nice. I can go with them. And then this is the last of them. And how is a monk well liberated by wisdom? Here, monks, a monk understands. Lust, hatred, and delusion have been abandoned by me. Cut off at the root, made barren like palm tree stumps, obliterated so that they are no more subject to rise in the future. And this way, a monk is well liberated by wisdom. In other words, at this point, this monk is fully awakened. You cut off at the root. I mean, you know, the root is where things keep coming back, right? Doesn't even come back. And then he says this really interesting thing at the end of the sutta. Whatever noble ones in the past amongst abided in noble abodes, all abided in just these 10 noble abodes. But the noble ones in the future will abide in these noble abodes, all will abide in just these 10 noble abodes. Whatever noble ones at present abide in noble abodes, all abide in just these 10 noble abodes. He's saying, it doesn't make any difference what my teaching says or what other teachings have said. This is what an enlightened being is. This is a detailed description of someone who's enlightened. And that doesn't change based on history or teaching or teacher or anything. This is what an enlightened being is. It's what it's actually described, the progressive steps. This is yet another of those progressive steps suttas. These monks are the 10 noble abodes in which the noble ones abided in the past, abide at present, and will abide in the future. So he's saying it doesn't make any difference how, what practice you were doing or how you got there, whether it was like today or 1,000 years ago or 1,000 years from now. It doesn't make any difference. This is what enlightened being is. He's not messing around. He's saying this is what all enlightened beings are, without exception. Which is an interesting statement, I think, in and of itself. I mean, it's like he's being very, this is how it is, folks. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, it's, I keep coming back and saying this, but this is aspirational, of course, for the rest of us. I mean, you know, maybe one of you is enlightened, I don't know it. That's a possibility, I suppose. But for the rest of us, we're just aspiring towards moving gradually towards these things. I want to finish with this little poem from Mary Oliver's book, Why Wake Early, called Logos, which in a sense, in a poetic Mary Oliver sort of sense, describes this aspirational sense that I've been talking about. Also, it's called Logos. Why wonder about the loaves and fishes? If you say the right words, the wine expands. If you say them with love, and the felt ferocity of that love, and the felt necessity of that love, the fists explode into many. Imagine him speaking, and don't worry about what is reality, or what is plain, or what is mysterious. If you were there, it was all those things. If you can imagine it, it is all those things. Eat, drink, be happy. Accept the miracle. Accept, too, each spoken word spoken with love. That's an aspiration, too. That's like Mary Oliver putting into words what I've just been saying for the last 40 minutes or so. So that's all I have to share today. And I'm going to turn off.